had a question on Matthew 11:11. It talks about heaven, and it talks about John the Baptist being the greatest man that was ever born of a woman, and how even he is not, he'll be the lowest of anybody in heaven. I'm always curious about heaven, and I'm not sure that makes sense to me. Is it because he has Adam's sin when he's on the earth, and he'll be...
Yeah, you're hitting in the right direction. But let me address, why don't we all look at Matthew 11:11. Assuredly, I say to you, among those born of women, there has not risen one greater than John the Baptist. But he who is least in the kingdom of heaven is greater than he. The comparison here, before I start on that, kingdom of heaven is an earthly heaven, is an earthly kingdom. I'm sorry, that didn't come out right. Kingdom of God or kingdom of heaven, both are references to the millennial kingdom. And how often do you hear people say, thank heaven?
Often, yeah.
But what do they mean? Thank God who is in heaven. I take kingdom of God and kingdom of heaven as the same reference. Matthew is the only book that uses the phrase kingdom of heaven. The term kingdom of God shows up many places in the New Testament. Matthew has both kingdom of heaven and kingdom of God. And what it's saying is, compared to people in the millennium that will have resurrection bodies, resurrected believers, John is nothing compared to what people will be. I'm not saying John's nothing compared to what he will be.
Both physically and spiritually?
Yeah. Now, there are a couple of other things that arise as questions in this passage. Let's back up a little bit. Notice that John the Baptist has sent two of his disciples in order to ask questions of Jesus. And so in verse 2, when John had heard in prison, John was in prison because of what he had said about Herod Antipas and his wife. He sent two of his disciples and said to him, are you the coming one, or do we look for another? Now, when people see that statement, they say, wait a moment, didn't John the Baptist have direct revelation that he was supposed to anoint this one, Jesus Christ? Now, look at the compliment that Jesus then says about him a few moments later in verse 9. But what did you go out, that is, go out to the wilderness where John was baptizing, to see? A prophet, yes, I say, and more than a prophet. Jesus has very strong compliments concerning John. Now, does that sound odd that he would have compliments for John when John said, are you the one, or do we look for another? Many people look at this and say, John has abandon any concept that Jesus could be the Messiah. Not at all. In Judaism at this time, and there's a passage, and I was looking at it actually just today, in the Manual of Discipline, which was one of the Qumran documents, in 1Q... 1Q 9, verse 11. So that's in the first cave of Qumran, the particular document, says that when the prophet and the messiahs, plural, of Israel and Aaron come. Israel, during the first century, there were many rabbis that taught that there were two messiahs. You may have heard people refer to Messiah ben David and Messiah ben Joseph. Ever hear that terminology?
B-I-N.
Pardon?
B-I-N. Ben.
Right, well, it means son
yeah.
of.
Yeah. Son of David.
And so the concept that they had was they couldn't reconcile passages saying that he was going to be lowly and come riding a donkey with passages saying that he was going to be a conqueror. So they ended up saying two messiahs. And what I think is happening with John the Baptist is he's saying, are you the one and only, or do we expect another? Are you the first messiah with us expecting a second one? And what Jesus does is he gives an answer that says that he is the one who is to come. Now, anytime people would ask Jesus questions, you know that when he gave an answer, they were wishing that they had asked for two questions. Because what Jesus didn't say to him is, I'm coming again. There's only one Messiah, but the one Messiah comes first in humiliation, and the second time he comes in glory. Okay, any other questions while reading? On our while you're thinking, on our website we have posted a Bible reading schedule that we're going through. So for those of you, and our website is MOL316. Message of Life, John 3:16. So on the homepage there is a reading schedule.
Here's a general question, John.
Okay.
So in the 3 years that Jesus ministered, how much time was spent in Jerusalem? Can you kind of just take us through how this time kind of went and when, why he would go to Jerusalem, where he spent most of his time,
sure.
why?
Sure.
An overview, maybe.
Let's set two pegs on our timetable. First one would be, and I'm doing it from your perspective, not from mine. So the first one here is going to be the start of Jesus' public ministry with his baptism. And then the ending point will be 1 week before his crucifixion, when he came to Jerusalem the last time. Now, between those two pegs, how many verses do you think explicitly in Matthew say that Jesus was in or around Jerusalem?
Zero.
What about Mark? Zero. What about Luke? Four verses. That's in Luke chapter 10, where Jesus is ministering to Mary and Martha, and you remember that Martha wanted some help doing the housekeeping, and Mary was listening to Jesus as he was teaching. That's four verses in Bethany, which is about a mile away from Jerusalem. Now, how much of John, between those two peg points, do you think is devoted to Jesus being in Jerusalem or very close to Jerusalem? 51% of the verses. In the Gospel of John, Jesus spends most of his time in Jerusalem. Now, this is when I make this statement, you'll have to think about it a moment. John shows Jesus on vacation. There were three pilgrim feasts that we're told about in the book of Deuteronomy. The three pilgrim feasts were Passover, and the Feast of Unleavened Bread, which was attached to it. The Festival of Weeks, also known as Pentecost, which was 50 days after Passover. And then the Feast of Booths, also known as Tabernacles. So you have three feasts that it says in Deuteronomy that all Jewish males were required to attend those annually. Jesus lived up north. He lived in Galilee. And when you look at Matthew, Mark, and Luke, almost all of his time is devoted up north, where he lived. So shall we say that's where he was in his workaday world. But when he went on vacation, guess where he went? To Jerusalem. Now there's a reason that he would go to Jerusalem. Now, there was one year that he avoided Jerusalem for an entire year. It's not hard to demonstrate that. There was one entire year that Jesus did not go down to Jerusalem. You can verify that both from John and Matthew. But the interesting thing is, when we look at Matthew, Mark, and Luke, a great deal of time is devoted to training his disciples so that they would be able to carry on his ministry. But when he went to Jerusalem, there was instantaneous persecution. The religious officials opposed Jesus strenuously. So you might say, well, why not avoid Jerusalem altogether? Jesus knew that for all the feasts, there would be all kinds of people who would come into Jerusalem. And what we see is the Gospel of John tells us about Jesus going to various feasts. John chapter 2, verse 13 mentions that it was near the time of Passover. And Jesus was in Jerusalem, and we're told that while he was there, that many believed in him. What he did when he was in Jerusalem was he faced the scrutiny of the religious officials. Now imagine, now we know that the Gospel of John is presenting Jesus as the Messiah. Now imagine that Jesus never went to Jerusalem and he just stayed up there in Galilee. What did Judeans think of Galilee?
Nothing.
Yeah, they didn't have anything positive to say about it. And they'd say, well, what do they know? How in the world can you say this man has proven himself to be the Messiah when he's only been examined by Galileans? But on the other hand, if you're trying to train disciples and prepare them to carry on when he is resurrected and ascends back to heaven, how much time would Jesus have for training his disciples if day in and day out he were in Jerusalem and people were constantly trying to kill him? So that's why I say Jesus in the Gospel of John goes to Jerusalem on vacation. He normally was there for a week at a time, but most of the year he was spending in Galilee. And that's where he did the bulk of his ministry.
Hey,
But he always went down to Jerusalem, and the religious leaders became very upset because they could never pin him down. Yes.
So why would he go on vacation where he's running into the school? I mean, so when I go on vacation, I'd rather go to the happier place, and I would take the disciples and train them in the land of scrutiny. As opposed, wouldn't you take your team and go into the hard stuff first, and then on vacation go where it's easy for you?
Well,
you see what I'm saying?
He needed to teach them. They had a lot of teaching that they needed to be exposed to.
So they also
needed to see him ministering to people rather than just answering objections. When Jesus was in Jerusalem, much of the time that he spent was answering objections.
Right, it was so why would he vacation
there? It's a requirement of the males to go to the feast.
I think John's saying vacation almost facetiously.
Yes.
Yeah.
I don't mean...
He's not taking time off. He's going there for the hardship of facing the
scrutiny,
and that's where the training is occurring.
Well, that's where the disciples are seeing the acid test. But they're getting their studies to prepare them for it.
Place at base, and then we launch into enemy territory to do our work. Okay.
Right.
Thank you. I missed something.
Yeah. I was using vacation in a somewhat facetious sense.
I got you. I like sarcasm.
Leaving home. Yeah. Well, wasn't there a requirement that if you were a male to go to the three feasts?
Right, yes. Now, it's not hard to demonstrate that Jesus boycotted Jerusalem for an entire year. Most people don't realize that. And let's take a look, and I'll point out a few things. Let's look in John chapter 6.
I'm sorry, hold on. You said that was the tabernacles. You called it something else.
Booths.
B-O-O-T-H.
Yes.
Thank you.
What they did was they made temporary dwellings and lived in them for 6 nights.
They look like booths.
And so the Gospel of John, in John 7 through the first half of John 10 is the Feast of Booths, the year before Jesus was crucified. Notice in John chapter 6, verse 4. Now the Passover, a feast of the Judeans, was near. So it's mentioning this particular feast. I believe that particular feast Jesus did not attend in Jerusalem. Look now at John chapter 7, verse 1. And it's not the announcement of a new policy. It is a continuing policy which he soon brings to an end. John 7, 1, after these things, that is a non-precise type of temporal marker. Now, when I say not precise, I am not saying not accurate. There is a major difference between accurate and precise. This is accurate, but it's not precise. If I were to say, it's 6 o'clock, well, it's closer to 6 than it is to 3. You know, it's that general vicinity of the time. It's an accurate statement if I'm just hitting ballpark, but it is not precise. I could get like Spock and get down to the hundredth or the thousandth of a second. If I were that precise, there's a difference between accurate and precise. There is no statement of how much time has elapsed between chapter 6 and chapter 7, just as at the beginning of chapter 5, it also says after these things, which is again a non-precise time marker. After these things, Jesus walked in Galilee, for he did not want to walk in Judea because the Judeans wanted or sought to kill him. This is not the start of a new policy. This is the continuation of an existing policy that he is not going to Jerusalem because there are plots to kill him. now drop down to what his brothers, his half-brothers, said to him. They said in verse 3, "Depart from here and go into Judea, that your disciples may also see the works that you are doing." Now, why would they be telling him, go to Jerusalem, if he went to Jerusalem every feast? They're a little nervous that Jesus hasn't been going there for a while. Now look at what happens.
Why nervous? I'm sorry, General.
Well, okay, his half-brother, since the parents, both Joseph and Mary, were Judeans, and Joseph was a landowner. Now let me establish how we know that he was a landowner. Censuses were only taken for two purposes: either to count your army or to raise taxes. And it was registered landowners who had to appear. And so there were undoubtedly a number of brothers, so the piece of property was there in Bethlehem was, he was a shareholder, shall we say, rather than, this is my farm. And so he needed to appear because he would have property taxes that would come due because he was a part owner of some land in Bethlehem. That's the reason for the census that brought them down to Bethlehem at the time that Jesus was about to be born. The half-brothers are Jerusalem or Judean loyalists. And although they lived in Galilee, their affections were very strongly pro-Judea, and they were part of a large Judean populace that lived up in Galilee. But notice what they say in verse 3, "Depart from here, go into Judea, that your disciples may also see the works that you are doing. For no one does anything in secret while he himself seeks to be known openly. If you do these things, show yourself to the world." Now we have an editorial remark, "For even his brothers did not believe in him." Then Jesus said to them, "My time has not yet come, but your time is always ready. The world cannot hate you, but it hates me because I testify that its works are evil. You go up to this feast. I am not yet going." Some of your Bibles do not say yet. They ought to. "I am not yet going up to this feast, for my time is not fully come." When he had said these things to them, he remained in Galilee. But when his brothers had gone up, then he also went up to the feast, not openly, but as it were in secret. Now we have a meanwhile back in Jerusalem in verse 11. Then the Judeans sought him at the feast and said, "Where is he?" And there was much complaining among the people concerning him. Some said he is good, and so on and so forth. But they're saying, "I bet he won't show up. He hasn't been coming here. He's afraid to come here. He's not going to come." Now, some of you may be saying, "Oh, you're making a good circumstantial case, but where's the proof? Where's the proof that Jesus had boycotted Jerusalem for a whole year?" Glad you asked. Good question. Let's turn to Matthew 17. Matthew 17. This is a passage that is only in Matthew, and all you fishermen are very familiar with this passage. In verse 24, when they, Jesus and his disciples, had come to Capernaum, that's up in Galilee, that's way up north on the Sea of Galilee, those who received the temple tax came to Peter and said, "Does your master not pay the temple tax?" Now, do you notice anything odd about that?
You pay the temple tax in Jerusalem, right?
Right, but notice is this a question that is being posed like tax collectors that you're familiar with? I mean, doesn't it sound like it's optional?
Yeah.
Have you ever heard of a tax that was optional?
It's accusative.
They're trying to shame Peter into, he's not a deadbeat, is he? He pays his temple tax, doesn't he? These were officials that were sent out from Jerusalem, but once they got out of Judea, they had no authority to compel anyone to do anything. So in a sense, it was a voluntary tax. People who didn't go to Passover ever never paid the tax. The tax was due and payable when you showed up in Jerusalem to go into the temple at Passover. So they kept a list of everyone that came into the temple and paid their temple tax. Then they go through their list and they say, well, Jesus normally comes and he normally pays his temple tax. He didn't come. So they send these tax collectors all throughout the countryside and they're trying to shame Peter into getting Peter to end up coughing up the tax. Now, the reason that they are doing that is because Jesus didn't go to the temple the previous Passover. That was the Passover that was mentioned in John chapter 6, verse 4. So Jesus did not legalistically say, I have to go to every feast in Jerusalem. He had no problem. He skipped a whole year. And it's interesting, in John chapter 7, Jesus said, I did one wonder, making a man whole on the Sabbath, and you want to kill me. And guess what? In saying that, he was referring to a miracle that he did in John 5 a whole year earlier. Now, why would they still be angry at him for that one if he had been down there in the meantime? So, most people are not aware that Jesus boycotted Jerusalem for an entire year. But it takes a fair amount of digging to get some of the puzzle pieces pulled together. But there was a whole year in Jesus' ministry that he did not go to Jerusalem at all.
So do we know what feast in John 5 was?
No, we do not. I used to, with trepidation, say that that was Feast of Booths. Right now, I am inclined to think that it was the missing Passover in John's Gospel. We know that there's let me go to... we're digressing quite a bit, but that's fine. Let's go to John chapter 2. And it's kind of funny. For a different reason, I brought this book with me. Anyone who's interested in pursuing chronological issues in the Gospels, this book is just about the only thing that's written comprehensively on it. It's by Harold Honer, H-O-E-H-N-E-R, Chronological Aspects of the Life of Christ. He was my dissertation advisor. So, Chronological Aspects of the Life of Christ, Harold Honer.
And it's available in ebooks too. You can buy it right on the, like, have it on your tablet.
So, it's, I recommend it strongly, but let's go to, I have a couple of areas where I hold different conclusions than his, but by and large, I'm in agreement with him most of the way through. But let's go to John chapter 2. We have a terrible translation here. I'll tell you what, I'll pull out my Greek text and I won't even look at my English. I'll just translate it. The translators didn't know what to do here. And when translators get lost, they improvise. And every English translation improvises on this verse. It's just awful. Jesus is there at the temple in Jerusalem, and he cleanses the temple the first of two times that he does so.
John, what verse?
John chapter 2, verse 20. And what we have is Judeans that are saying, prove to us that you have the authority to chase everyone out of the temple here that's selling and changing money. Then the Judean said, 46 years has this sanctuary been built, and you, in 3 days, will raise it? It is not saying that they've been building it for 46 years. It is that it was completed 46 years earlier. Now, here's why they get all confused. Remember, I say translators, when they get lost, they improvise. They said, but wait a moment, wasn't the temple still being built while Jesus was there, clear up until the crucifixion? Wasn't it still being built after? Haven't you heard that? Well, yes, that's true. However, this isn't the word for the temple. This is the word for sanctuary. It's not the word hieron. For those of you who would like to hang on to that word, the word for the hieron, the word for the temple as a whole, we get the English word hieroglyphics from it, or hierarchy. A hierarchy is all sorts of layers of priests. And so hieron is the word for the whole temple precincts. But this is the naos. This is the holy place and the holy of holies. And lo and behold, in Josephus' Antiquities, or it may be Wars of the Jews. Right now I don't remember which one of his writings. It would have been Wars of the Jews. He dates the start of the building of the sanctuary. Interestingly, the sanctuary was built by Levitical priests, but the rest of the precincts were built by ordinary people. The sanctuary and the holy place and the holy of holies were built by priests, and he dates the start of it, and he also says it took 18 months to complete. And guess what? It was 46 years before the year 30 that the sanctuary was completed. When we compare the chronology of Josephus with the chronology established by the Gospel of John, it is 46 years from the completion of the sanctuary to the time that Jesus is having this discussion. And what this passage is, John 2:13, is it's the first of Jesus' Passovers in his ministry, and he was crucified on Passover, actually on the Judean Passover, in the year 33. The reason I make a differentiation between the Judean Passover and the Galilean Passover is that Passover was determined by a phase of the moon, and they had observers that would go out and make sure exactly when Passover came. Very, very interesting feature. Depending on whether you were in Galilee or whether you were in Jerusalem, the people had a different way of telling time. As to whether you start the day at dawn or you start the day at sundown. And then there was another time procedure which had a middle of the night type of starting for the day. Well, lo and behold, because of the way the Galileans told time, Thursday of the year 33 in April is when their Passover was. Jesus ate a Passover meal on the Galilean calendar with his disciples. But he was crucified the next day, Friday, on the Judean Passover. So Jesus ate Passover at the Passover time of the Galileans, and he was crucified at the time of the slaughter of the sheep on the Judean Passover. Now you might wonder, why would the temple officials be interested in accommodating Galileans with a different time period? Well, it's really easy to answer. How many churches do you know have two or three or four services so that they can get more people to have an offering plate go in front of their nose? Well, it turned out the religious officials said, this is just great. The Galileans want to have their Passover a day early. We don't have to have as many animals being slaughtered that day. And then we have the next day to slaughter for the Judeans. And so you have two separate... Now, some of you may be wondering, why is it that I hold to a Friday crucifixion? That's very easy to answer. How many passages in the entire Bible speak of 3 days and three nights that Jesus would be in the ground? How many passages? One. That one passage is Matthew chapter 12, verse 40. Matthew 12, 40 is the only reason. It is the only reason. There is not any other reason that anyone would propose a Thursday or a Wednesday crucifixion. It's only because of Matthew chapter 12, verse 40. Now, since Matthew 12 was part of the reading there for this week, I figured that I probably had better bring this. So, I'm going to ask for some volunteers. We're going to have six passages to be read. It's just going to be a single verse. And so, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. So, reading number one will be Genesis 42, verse 17. Who will take that? Okay, someone else take Genesis 42, 18. And who will take 1 Kings 20, 29?
I'll do that.
Okay, and then 2 Chronicles 10, 5. Okay, and 2 Chronicles 10, 12. Okay, actually, I have two more. Esther 5:1 and Esther 4:16. Okay, very good. So, Genesis 42:17.
So we put them all together in prison 3 days.
Okay, they are being in prison 3 days. Now, who has verse 18?
Go ahead.
Then Joseph said to them the third day, do this and live, for I fear God.
Notice, we wouldn't say after a three-day imprisonment, that being released on the third day would equal the same thing, would we? Because we'd say if they're released on the third day, they've only had 2 days of imprisonment. Okay, and then someone had 1 Kings 20:29.
Wait, so what's the point of that?
2029.
What we have is an idiom that 3 days equals on the third day.
I see.
So we've got an idiom, and our idiom doesn't work the same way as the idiom that the Israelites had. And so we look at it and we say, we wouldn't use that terminology to describe that. Okay. Who has 1 Kings 20:29?
I do.
Okay.
And they encamped opposite each other for 7 days. So it was that on the seventh day the battle was joined, and the children of Israel killed 100,000 foot soldiers of the Syrians in 1 day.
Okay. Now some of you might still be saying, but what about and nights? Have you ever heard someone say, I worked day and night at my job to get this done? Well, how many people do you know put in 24-hour shifts? We have an idiom we use night and day for saying, I was working on it continually. We have an idiomatic usage. And what I have seen in looking at a number of written sources is that if you have any part of a day or any part of a night fits within the Hebrew idiom there to say, it can be referred to as day and night. Okay, 2 Chronicles 10:5.
Rehoboam answered, come back to me in 3 days, so the people went away.
Okay, and then verse 12.
Oh, 3 days later, Jeroboam and all the people returned to Rehoboam.
So what we have is a number of places where we see this idiomatic usage. And then, Becky, you had a passage in Esther.
Yeah, Esther 4:16. Go gather together all the Jews who are in Susa and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, day, night or day. And then it goes on.
Okay, and then 5:1.
On the third day, Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner courts of the palace in front of the king's hall.
Okay, then we have another passage that we can add. 1 Samuel 30, verses 12 and 13. What we have here is an abandoned Egyptian servant and what he's saying when he was found. 30, 12 and 13.
And they gave him a piece of cake of figs and 2 clusters of raisins. So when he had eaten, his strength came back to him, for he had eaten no bread nor drunk water for 3 days and nights. Then David said to him, to whom do you belong and where are you from? And he said, I am a young man from Egypt, servant of Amalekite, and my master left me behind because 3 days ago I fell sick.
Now, there's an important reason. I mean, it ends up being an important factor to say what day of the week was Jesus crucified. A lot of people say, well, that's not a big deal. Except that because Passover is determined by an astronomical observance, it changes the year if you don't have the right date of the week. So what needs to happen is that in order to determine when it is that Jesus was crucified, we have to have, in my opinion, a Friday. We have to have Annas alive and functioning. We have to have Caiaphas alive and functioning. Pilate has to be in power. There are a whole series of things that have to happen. And 33 is the one date that fits the absolute best when you start looking at all the factors that have to be put together. But most people are not aware that the idioms that Jewish people had in biblical times are a little different than our English idiom. And the only passage that mentions Jesus being in the ground 3 days and three nights is Matthew 12:40. And I believe it's an idiomatic expression, because we have passages that speak about him being resurrected on the third day, and then we have that passage saying he was in the grave 3 days and three nights. And the way the idiom works on the third day is how we would express it. But the way that it was expressed by Jewish people, even in a book as late as Esther, makes it very clear that they understood on the third day as equivalent to 3 days, or to 3 days and three nights.
And you're still building to why that's so critical.
It determines what year it can be, because Passover did not automatically fall on a certain day of the week. So it determines the year. I mean, day of the week ends up determining what year it would end up being. So chronology is turned all over the place if we don't have control over what year it was. So day of the week might not sound like a big thing, but since it affects which year it can be, it changes a lot of things. So
you get I think, John, when you said all those people, you could actually say all the stars had to align.
Yeah, using star in a little different way than most people.
The celebrities.
So anyway, I do recommend this book highly, and if you pick it up and you want to ask me where I have differences of opinion with it, I can go into that, but not tonight. Okay, let's go to Revelation. Questions often come up on Matthew 12:40, so I figured I better bring the book. I'm going to do a bit of review that will clue us in as to what I covered last week. We talked about the Church of Laodicea last week. Right now we're just doing specials here over the summer, and I hadn't even planned on doing Church of Philadelphia this week until it turned out that we had a fairly small group with us last week, so I figured, well, okay, if I stay in Revelation 3, then I can use the same contextual introduction and we can have a quick review. Revelation 1:19 is the outline statement for the book of Revelation. Write the things which you saw, the things which are, and the things which are about to happen after these things. So chapter 1 is the things which John has seen in his vision. Chapters 2 and 3 are talking about seven churches over which John was like a supervisor. And I've got a map here on the handout that I have and the one that I gave last week that shows that those seven churches were arranged in a circuit. So John would go in a circle to visit all seven churches. And so that was something right then during the first century. That's the things which are. And the things which are about to happen after these things are chapters 4 through 22 of the book, with chapters 6 through 19 being the tribulation, that 7-year period of time that is yet future. Now, you may have heard sermons where the preacher takes it that each church stands for an age, for a long period of time. In my considered opinion, that is poppycock. The first piece of evidence therefore, this not being a reference to ages within the church is that they are in a clockwise circuit, a logical route for John to go. They are the churches to which he ministered. But John is right now unable to minister to them because he has been exiled to the island of Patmos. And so, because John has been forced to neglect these seven churches, some problems have developed within them. And so Jesus addresses things which are right now problems going on in those churches, because when the cat is away, the mice bite. Second reason, and I think this is an even bigger reason for rejecting the prophetic time period view of the seven churches, is that the rapture was imminent in John's day, just as it is now. It could be next moment. There's nothing that had to happen first. But if he's saying, well, there are going to be these seven ages here within the church that are going to take up 2,000 years, how can he say that at the same time say, and it could happen at any time? If he doesn't make an announcement that it's going to be a long time, then he's free to, it can be whenever it needs to happen. We have a tendency to look back and say, well, there was a long period of time in between, and as a result, people have wanted to fill in the blanks so that they could preach these what's said in these churches to all the people in their churches. Furthermore, the book of Revelation gives no indication whatsoever that these were anything but literal seven churches to which John ministered. So, I do not take it, as many would like to say, that the church of Laodicea represents a period of apostasy within the church. Each of the churches was to hear the letters that were written to the other six churches. So that in 2:7, 2:11, 2:17, 2:29, 3:6, 3:13, and 3:22, each one of them says, he who has an ear to hear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the seven to the churches. Now there are commonalities and there are differences between each of those seven letters in John, in Revelation 2 and 3. One point of commonality, a point that's similar, is that each one starts by addressing the angel, which we'll discuss what that is, of an individual church. Then each speaks of Jesus knowing the works of each church. Next, each of them offers a practical exhortation and or warning, including urging them to hear, to heed. And each concludes with a promise to those who become overcomers. Overcomers are rewardable believers. But there are some differences. Four of the churches, Ephesus, Pergamos, Thyatira, and Sardis, received both praise and rebuke. Two of the churches, Smyrna and Philadelphia, and by the way, it's not Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. It's Philadelphia in Turkey. Two of the churches only received praise. And one church, Laodicea, that we focused on last week, received only rebuke. Now, each one of these churches, it says, to the angelos, which our translations have just said the angel. Notice how angelos sounds like angel?
L-U-S?
Angelos.
S.
O-S.
O-S.
And so the question here becomes, what does the word angelos in Greek mean? If someone says angel, that doesn't define it at all. That's just making the same sound. The word angelos means messenger. Now you may be familiar with the word evangelism. Well, the ev that's at the beginning of it comes from the Greek word eu, E-U. Eu means good. And angelizo means to give a good, or to give a message. So it means to give a good message. The concept of angelos or angelizo or any of these related words is a messenger who has a message. In the Bible, we find some messengers that are human, and we find others that are not human, and so guess what we've done? We haven't bothered to define what kind of being they are. We just said, oh, let's paste the Greek word in there, and we'll call them angels. You know, it's like if I say baptism. Well, the fact that baptism is not an English word. It's a Greek word. It comes from baptizo. Well, to say baptize, all sorts of people fill in the blank. Some say, let's sprinkle. Some say, let's dip. Some say, let's dunk. And some say, you can do it to kids. And others say, you do it only to believers. Now, let me give the short on it. The idzo ending means to cause, to do something. There's a Greek word, bapto. Notice bapto is like baptizo, except it doesn't have the I-Z in it. When you hear the word, when you hear English words and they have ids in it, or I's, it means to cause something to happen. For example, terror. And terrorize. It means cause someone to have terror. Now, everyone agrees, all Greek scholars agree on what the word bapto means. It means to dip. Baptizo means to cause someone to be dipped. Doesn't have a thing to do with sprinkling. But notice, what we have is only a Greek word is being pronounced in an English way. That doesn't tell us what it means. Now, I'd like us to turn to Luke and...
As opposed to the mist concept.
Right. So it's an immersion type of concept.
Different than the mist that we discussed.
Dunkin' Donuts.
Yeah. So let's look at Luke. We looked at the parallel to the Luke passage in Matthew, where the messengers of John the Baptist came, and they asked Jesus if he were the one or if they should expect another. And so in Luke chapter 7, verse 19, it says, John calling two of his disciples, I would assume they're human, wouldn't you? Sent them to Jesus saying, are you the coming one or do we look for another? But now, if we were to translate this from Greek in verse 24, when the angelos, actually angeloi, the plural, the messengers, we wouldn't say these are angels. They're obviously humans. The word angelos just means messenger. I would argue in the book of Revelation that it is talking about humans, human messengers. I would say it would be the teaching elder of each of these churches. Let me ask a question. Does God need to write a letter in order to communicate to angels? It wouldn't make much sense. John, write this letter so that this angel can find out what I have to say. Somehow that doesn't seem very logical. I think furthermore, with the church at Thyatira, if we translate it like my majority text, Greek text, would read, but I have this against you, singular, the angelos at the church of Thyatira, that you, singular, permit your wife, Jezebel, to teach, and to teach false doctrine. Well, you know, when we read Matthew chapter 22, we find out that the supernatural beings that we call angels, they don't marry or give in marriage, right? But this is an angel that's married. It's a messenger, a human messenger that's married. Okay, each of the churches consists of believers. And that's important in that passage because people often think, well, Revelation 3:20 is how to get saved, how to get eternal life. And I'm going to quote the verse that you recall it. Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hear my voice and open the door, I will come in to him and dine with him and he with me. Have you ever heard people say, got to invite Jesus into your heart to get everlasting life? Well, this is a major passage from which they get it. But the only reason that they would say that about this verse is because they don't have the foggiest idea what this verse means. And we're going to have a little spelling test a little later, and that'll help to solidify it. What Jesus says in verse 14 is he's introducing his message to the messenger. By the way, the way that I would see this is, every time you see the word you in here, it's going to be you singular. Greek has a you plural. It has a y'all. But y'all doesn't show up here. It's you singular. He is addressing the messenger, the teaching elder of this church, of each of the seven churches. Now imagine that you have a company and there's a major breakdown that happens at one of your locations. Are you going to call on the carpet as the owner of this company each and every employee there at that location? You're probably much more likely to call the manager on the carpet. And then the manager is going to be expected to make sure that things get addressed in that location. What Jesus is doing is he is addressing the teaching elder. And the teaching elder is the one who is being addressed by the you singular. But the church has been hearing a message from the teaching elder in each of the cases that might have some problems. So, what he's telling the messenger, teaching elder in verse 14, is that the Amen, which is speaking about something to be believed, the faithful and true witness, the beginning of creation of God, that is the one who did creation, the one who was there in the beginning, who created. He said, I've got truth for you. And I think the implication is you have strayed from truth as you're proclaiming a message to your congregation. Now in verse 15, it says, I know your works, that you are neither cold nor hot. I could wish that you were cold, or hot. The city of Laodicea was a nice place in a lot of ways, but don't drink the water there. Its water came from a limestone deposit, and it was heavy duty with minerals. It did not taste good. But furthermore, the source of the water that was several miles away, the water was hot. They had hot springs. But then they sent it through pipes, and some of those pipes are still visible, and they've come apart, and they are coated inside with all kinds of mineral deposits. Well, their water ended up starting out very hot, and there were mineral baths, you know, sort of like at Glenwood Springs and so on and so forth. But then by the time it got to Laodicea, it was lukewarm, it stank, and it didn't taste good. And so Jesus is saying, you know what, Pastor, you stink. That's what he's telling him. He's saying, you're like the water there in your town. You really ought to go buy some bottled water. No, you really ought to come and get some from me. Now notice then he says, I know your works, verse 16. So then, because you are lukewarm, and neither cold nor hot, I will vomit you out of my mouth. This wouldn't be a nice water to take a bath in. It wouldn't be nice water to drink. He's saying, you're awful. But then in verse 17, because you say I am rich, and have become wealthy, and have need of nothing, and do not know that you are wretched, miserable, poor, blind, and naked. Well, let me tell you something about the history of Laodicea. In the year 60, they had a gigantic earthquake. And guess what? The federal government, the Romans, came along and said, we'll help you rebuild. But there were lots of strings attached to their money. Laodicea said, no thanks. Because Laodicea was a banking center, and they even minted their own coins. They had a lot of money. And they said, we're going to rebuild on our own. And they did. At the time that John wrote, because I hold an early date to the book of Revelation, they were still pinched financially because they were funding their own rebuilding. And I've got pictures that I showed last week of their main street. I mean, it was quite the place. Fantastic buildings. It was a wealthy location, and lots of those buildings toppled during the earthquake. But they say, we're rich enough, we can handle it on our own. And that's the way they approach the Christian way of life. They said, we're sufficient, we're doing fine. Their pastor isn't teaching truth, and he thinks that he's self-sufficient, and the congregation has the same attitude. So what he says in verse 18 to these believers is, I counsel you to buy from me gold refined in the fire. Talking about the testing of faith, that you may be rich, and white garments, which the book of Revelation in chapter 19 defines as the good works of believers, the good works of the saints. That the shame of your nakedness may not be revealed, and anoint your eyes with eye salve that you may see. These people do not, they're not hearing a message of truth, and they don't see truth well. Very interesting thing in verse 19. As many as I love, I rebuke and chasten. And that word for chasten is a very interesting word. The Greek word for chasten is paiduo. And a Greek word for the child is paideon. This is proper household discipline. It is not talking about the way that you deal with some total stranger if the kid happens to come along and destroy some of your property. It's how you deal with your own child when something happens. And so it's dealing in love. He says that as many as I love, and he's talking about believers here. Now, verse 20, a verse that is widely misunderstood. Now, how many here have a New International Version? Okay, you're not going to see this, so if you have another Bible you can look on, or if you happen to remember how the verse is worded, Let me ask a question. How you spell into?
I-N-T-O.
Okay, I've heard I-N-T-O. Do I hear a second spelling for that? How does Revelation 3:20 spell it if you don't have an NIV? You have an NIV. They are not literal here.
Two words.
Two words. In and to. It's not one word. So now the question becomes, why would the translators make it two words? Very simple reason. The two-word form does not mean the same thing as the one-word form. It has a distinct meaning. So, if we were to look at Matthew 8:5, why don't we go ahead and turn there? We're just looking for a construction, and the construction here is ace, arachomai, ace. In Matthew 8:5, Jesus came into Capernaum. And notice into is spelled with one word. So it meant he was outside of Capernaum and he went into it. So that's, you're outside and you go into. And you know, when people hear Revelation 3:20, they think that you invite Jesus into your heart and he comes into. And that's how most people read this, right? But let's look at another passage.
So you're liking the word enter as a substitute.
Enter, but it would be enter to. It's not just enter.
And it didn't just walk in the door, but came, walked in to do something.
He walked in to the presence of. So he came in to. Let's look at Mark 6:25. Now this passage is a birthday celebration. It was a rather raucous one by Herod Antipas. And remember I said that John the Baptist was thrown into prison because he had something to say about Herod Antipas' marital practices. Mark chapter 6, verse 25. He has a stepdaughter that is dancing in front of him. And you remember the story. He was pretty taken by her, so he said, I'll give you anything up to half of my kingdom. You know, just tell me what you want, and I'll give it to you. And so she figured, well, I better go talk with Mom and see what Mom wants. I'm not sure if I really like my stepdad that much. I better find out from Mom what I ought to say. So her mother said, ask for the head of John the Baptist. And so then, verse 25, immediately she came in with haste to the king. She didn't jump inside of Herod Antipas. She didn't go. She came inside the banquet hall to his presence. In to does not mean the same thing as into. Now, let's picture. Got a door there. And Jesus is saying that he's standing outside the door and he's knocking. And there is a church that is assembled. And he's saying to the church that's assembled, I'm knocking. If someone hears and comes and says, welcome in, I'd like to join for a meal. He's saying, I'd like to have communion. Now notice what it says. I will sup with him and he with me. Now, if Jesus goes inside the individual, then we'd have to say the individual was supping on Jesus, not supping with him. You get the difference?
Mm-hmm.
So, Jesus wants to come inside the assembled believers to be able to sit across a table and enjoy table fellowship. So when you're talking to someone who thinks that this is invite Jesus into your heart,
right.
What I like to ask people is, how do you spell into? And they'll say, I-N-T-O. And I say, well, look here. How is it spelled here? It's two words. Why do you think the translators rendered it as two words? And then they're all ears. Then you can explain it. But if you say, the Greek says, they'll turn you off. But if you say, why did the translator do this? Then you have an open door to be able to explain the passage.
John, additionally, Jesus is talking to a church of believers, so they already have a relationship with Jesus.
Absolutely.
And supposedly he's with them, the Holy Spirit is with them.
Absolutely. But so many people ignore that, so that's why I was camping on the fact that these are believers already. Yes. Verse 21, notice Jesus says that the overcomer will sit with Jesus on his throne as Jesus overcame and now sits on the Father's throne. Now, throne is a concept that stands for authority to rule. I'm not thinking of the infinite God who is spirit sitting on a literal throne up there in heaven. It is a way of expressing the Father has authority to rule over the entire universe. And Jesus, after his crucifixion, resurrection, and ascension, was invited by the Father to share with him in the rulership over the universe. We have passages that speak about how he is presently seated. And that means he is presently sharing in responsibilities of ruling over the universe. But he says that he's going to be given his own throne. And where is that throne going to be? In Jerusalem. And during the millennium, he will rule over planet Earth. So he says, the Father privileged me to join with him in ruling, and the overcoming believer, the rewardable believer, I will give him the right to join me in ruling over my kingdom in the millennium. And so it speaks about rewards. But isn't this amazing? We'd have to look at this church and have to say they would score an F. They're terrible, aren't they? The pastor's terrible and the congregation isn't doing any better. And what does he speak about? What does he hold in front of them? The possibility of co-reigning with him. And our tendency is to look at our lives and say, oh, I don't measure up. God can't use me. I mess up so badly. You know, I sin. And I do terrible things. God doesn't love me, and God has no use for me. So I might as well not even seek to please him. That is not the way that this message concludes to a church that you would have to say was a failure. He holds forth the possibility of co-reigning with him. I see that as a tremendous presentation of what grace is all about.
So okay. No matter how much they've screwed up, they still have the opportunity to turn it around.
Yes.
That's encouraging for us.
Absolutely. Okay, I took a fair amount of time on review but I thought there that that's an important enough passage that I wanted to do so. Let's now look at the Church of Philadelphia. We're not going to look at the whole passage. I am going to be focusing on chapter 3, verse 10. This passage has, because of the way that people look at it, people have reached some interesting conclusions. I'd like you to turn to the back page of your notes. And what you are looking at is something like what manuscripts look like, except they're written in Greek. All capitals, no spacing, no punctuation. Now, can you find Revelation 3:10 in here?
I'll close one eye, really.
Yes, it's right near the middle. Because you kept my command to persevere, I also will keep you from the hour of trial which shall come upon the whole world to test those who dwell on earth. It takes a little bit of work to locate things here, but do you see why, when translators are translating, that they might start a sentence in a different place?
Yeah, that's a good example, actually.
Yeah, you look there and you might, I mean, this is a really good illustration of a punctuation problem that has plagued the interpretation of this verse. You can see how easy it is to punctuate things differently. So,
that's really clever. Did you think of this, or did you steal this from someone?
it looks like what manuscripts look like.
No, I get that, but I mean, is this your idea to have done it? Like, did you see this in class somewhere else? And it was a great tool.
I thought of it today. I've spoken on this
really?
Passage many times. I've used this for other things.
Okay. You've done it.
Yeah.
That's clever. It was well done.
It was
a good tool.
Okay, so the verse reads in New King James, because you have kept my command to persevere, I also will keep you from the hour of trial, which shall come upon the whole world to test those who dwell on the earth. Now, there are three views here. The first two I'm going to reject. Views of the rapture that either are or seem to be either supported or critiqued by this verse. The pre-tribulation rapture, which is my view, all church-age believers will be raptured. But there are people who hold to what's called a partial rapture view, and they say only church-age believers who persevere will be rewarded, or will be raptured. And then there is the dispensational perseverantist view, that's like John MacArthur, which says that all church-age believers will be raptured, but only those that persevere to the end are true believers. So,
yeah, what happens to the other guys? They fall out of the sky? Or what?
They get left on earth. They're left behind. Okay, now there's an interesting thing about the New King James and the King James. I don't know if you've noticed, but most Bible translations capitalize the first word of every verse. Even if the verse before it ended in a comma or no punctuation. Well, the King James translators back in 1611 started that practice. Verse numbers had already been put in. Greek texts had verse numbers. And so the King James translators started a procedure where they thought that a verse should be a whole sentence. Interestingly enough, I found 7 sentence fragments as a result. A very interesting thing that you run into when you look really closely. So if they saw a verse number, they thought that a sentence ought to start there. And they really tried as hard as they could to put final punctuation at the end of every verse. But verse numbers weren't in the original text either. That was a modern invention, or relatively modern. So, now we're going, for a moment, it'll seem like we're a little technical, just below the middle of the page. If Revelation 3:10 starts a sentence, and if, secondly, its first word, which is translated because with a capital B, and the Greek word would be hati, if it should be translated because with a capital B, the grammar would be highly unusual. Only about 10 sentences in the New Testament would have this same grammar. By the way, I've looked up all 1,100 uses of the word hati.
Of course you have.
I don't mind doing tedious work. That's not a problem.
What's the strangest of 1,100?
Oh, good question. The top three.
Or just one strange one.
Yeah.
Well, this one would be very strange, but I think verse 17 is a little odd, but it's been a few years since I did that. On the other hand, if, number one, verse 9 were to end in a comma, and the first word in verse 10 were translated because without a capital B, there are almost 400 sentences that match this grammar. Now, I knew that sometimes translators artificially began new sentences at verse breaks, and that this created odd grammar for Revelation 3:10. Therefore, I experimented with ending verse 9 with a comma. Now it would read, "Indeed, I will grant that those of the synagogue of Satan who say that they are Judeans and are not, but lie, behold, I will make them know that I have loved you, comma, because you have kept my word to persevere, period. And I will keep you from the hour of trial, which shall come upon the whole inhabited world to test the earth dwellers." So then I went about seeing, okay, first of all, would this work? And secondly, what was the evidence for which way it should be punctuated? The repunctuated text made sense, but it is important that we examine exactly what is involved. This will show why it is rare to start sentences with a capitalized because. Let me illustrate this. It's what's called a suspensive sentence, and for all of us who are parents, we have heard suspensive sentences. If your child comes to you and says, "Because of this rule, and because you said that, and because this is really important to you, and because, and because, and because, and because, and because," and you say, "Okay, what did you do?" What they're trying to do is hold in suspense the punchline, because they know that it's not going to be popular when they say it. And the times that we have a capitalized because, we're kind of trying to hold off saying the punchline because we don't want to say it right away.
Because we don't want to say it right away.
And so, both in English and in Greek, it is highly unusual to have sentences that are set up this way. It's called suspensive. You hold the punchline in suspense. Now, let's look at the next page. Now, I'm getting away from the technical terms now. Let us imagine that we encountered an ancient English manuscript, and it's all in caps, but I did separate the words for you. "I ate breakfast because I was hungry. I also ate an early lunch." Now, there are two ways we could punctuate it. Notice the parentheses on the left side. "I ate breakfast because I was hungry. I also ate an early lunch." Or we could say, as it's the parenthesis on the right, "I ate breakfast Because I was hungry, I also ate an early lunch. So notice, if you start out with a capitalized because, if a because starts a sentence, you're saying it's modifying the clause that comes after. But if it's a lowercase because, then you're saying it's modifying the sentence or the clause in front of it. And we hardly ever use capitalized because. And Greek hardly ever used a capitalized equivalent of because. So, now the question becomes, is the writer of this set of sentences trying to explain why he ate breakfast? Or is he trying to explain why he ate an early lunch? Now, if we transfer this to Revelation 3, 9b through 10, I will make them know that I have loved you, because you have kept my word to persevere, and I will keep you from the hour. And because punctuation is absent, and the manuscripts look like this, on the back page, you can see why we have to wrestle with where should the punctuation go. And the King James started a procedure of, if there's a verse number, I'm going to start the sentence there. And that's how they decided to do it. And I would say that there's a better way for us to go about deciding where the verse reference should go, where the sentence should start. Now, the issue is whether Jesus Christ seeks to explain why he will make the synagogue know that he loved the Philadelphians, or why he plans that the Philadelphians will not enter the hour. I mean, this is a pretty good-sized interpretive issue. Now, if this were my only argument, I could say the New Testament uses hati, that is the word because, in a way that view one interprets it about 100 times. But in the way that verse 2 interprets it as a capitalized because, it only uses about 10 times. That evidence favors view 1 but does not disprove view 2. What other evidence exists? So these are better arguments. View 1 reinforces the phrase, because you have kept my word, in verse 8. If you look at verse 8, it also has the same phrase. It looks a little different in our English translations. You have kept my word. Literally, in verse 10, you have kept my word, the word of my perseverance. So, it is a reinforcement of what verse 8 said. So in verse 8b, the following appears. I have set before you an open door, no one can shut it, for you have kept my word. The open door represents opportunity for ministry. The Lord has opened this door because, despite having only a little strength, sorry for the misspelling, they have kept his word and did not deny his name. This leads logically to what he says in 9b through 10a. I will make them know that I have loved you because you have kept my word to persevere. Notice the phrase, you have kept my word, appears both in verse 8 and verse 9, or verse 10. The first time, he does not say to persevere, but note the following phrase, you have not denied my name. That is, they persevered in standing up for the Lord. So it is a restatement of that idea. Not denying his name, but continuing to obey his word is another way of saying that they have persevered. They have kept his word to persevere. View 1 sees the Lord vindicating them because they kept his word. That reinforces the words repeated from verse 8. So view 1, the Lord gives ministry opportunity despite opposition because they've kept his word, 3a b. And the Lord will vindicate them before their persecutors because they have kept his word. But view 2 says the Lord gives them ministry opportunity despite opposition because they kept his word, and he will not let them enter the tribulation because they kept his word. View 1 makes more sense. It continues the flow of thought. Page 3. You, one, also makes sense of the word kago, which is translated "and I." It's in the middle of verse 10, where it's "I also will keep you." The "I also" could be translated "and I." New King James translation of Revelation 3:10 is fairly standard, and I've underlined the kago. Because you have kept my command to persevere, I also will keep you from the hour of trial which will come upon the whole world to test those who dwell upon the earth. Kai, which means and, normally connects like elements, two nouns, two verbs, two independent clauses, two dependent clauses, etc. Almost never does it connect an independent clause like Revelation 3:10b with a dependent one like 10a. Such usage here for view 2 would be quite unexpected. There's a much simpler thing. Notice as we look at this whole passage, starting at verse 8, how many times the word I, every time the word I shows up, it's talking about Jesus Christ. I, Jesus Christ, know your works. See, I, Jesus Christ, have set before you an open door, and no one can shut it, for you have a little strength and have kept my, that is Jesus Christ's word, and have not denied my, that is Jesus Christ's name. Behold, I, Jesus Christ, will make those of the synagogue of Satan, who say that they are Judeans but are not, but lie. Indeed, I, Jesus Christ, will make them come and worship me, is the idea, before your feet, and to know that I, Jesus Christ, have loved you, because you have kept my command to persevere. And I, Jesus Christ, will keep you from the hour of trial which shall come upon the whole world to test those who dwell on the earth. Notice how many times I comes up. And here on page 3, I have it set forth in the way that I would see this logically going. I know your works, 8a. I have set before you an open door. I will grant those of the synagogue of Satan, I will make them know, and verse 10b, I will keep you from the hour. I see the "and" connecting all the "I's." I've done this, I've done this, I've done this, and I will do this. That seems to be a far easier explanation of why that "and" is there in the middle of verse 10. In other words, the connection between points 1 through 4 is a comma in English, but the connection between the 4th and the 5th is an "and." This is in keeping with the normal use of the Greek word "and." So the evidence is that the grammar for view 1 is quite ordinary. First, it's only rarely that our English Bibles start a sentence with "because." Likewise, the word which starts verse 10b, the "and," most likely connects like items, I, and I. Thus, for it to link first-person verbs, I verbs, is expected, while the traditional punctuation creates something most unusual. The repetition of the phrase, "because you've kept my word," fits most naturally under the view that Christ opens doors of opportunity for a faithful church and vindicates them before their persecutors. The traditional punctuation does not flow as naturally. Analysis of the verse. Revelation 3:10b does not specify how Christ would keep them from the tribulation. Did he rapture the first century believers to prevent them from entering the tribulation? No, they died. He doesn't say, "I will rapture." He's saying, "I will keep you," without saying how he's going to keep them. The promise is, "I'm going to keep you from the hour." He kept the first century Philadelphians and even the Corinthians and the Laodiceans, and he kept all of them away from entering the tribulation by physical death. But the New Testament does teach that the last generation of the church will be prevented from entering the tribulation by being raptured before it starts. So Jesus hasn't said how he's going to prevent them from entering. He's just stated the fact I won't let you enter. So it's completely in harmony with the passages that teach that the rapture will prevent church-age believers from entering the tribulation. But Jesus wasn't making false representation. He didn't say, you Philadelphians, the way I'm going to keep you from entering the tribulation is I'm going to rapture you. What he promises, you're not going to enter. And even though the time of the rapture didn't happen in the first century, he kept his promise, but he didn't keep his promise by making a false one. Because if he had told them, I'm going to rapture you so you won't enter the tribulation, that wouldn't have been a true statement. Because he's talking to them. It is because people have read these and said, oh, he has to be talking to us, that they've ended up saying, oh, the church of Ephesus was the first period of time, and this church was the next period of time. No, no, no. We have to remember the hermeneutical hand. There's an original speaker to an original audience, an original writer to an original readership, and then we're out here twiddling our thumbs. We do not come into every you that shows up in the Bible. So that's a lot about repunctuating a verse. But you can see by looking at the back page why it is that I spend time wrestling with punctuation. Most people just assume punctuation, and I say, okay, there's an option here. Which way does it go?
That's really cool.
Okay, any questions? Yes.
So are you saying, on page 3 here, so are you saying that 1 Thessalonians 5:9 is also a deliverance passage rather than a rapture?
Oh, no, no, no.
You're not?
No.
Yeah, it harmonizes well. That doesn't mean it equates with a deliverance passage. That is the rapture passage.
Yes, that absolutely is. Because, let me, good question. Let's look at 1 Thessalonians 5. It's the first of the T books. Yeah. And they're all in alphabetical order. 1 Thessalonians, 2 Thessalonians, 1 Timothy, 2 Timothy, Titus. They're in alphabetical order. So it's the first of the T books. When we look at Revelation, I mean, 1 Thessalonians 5, Paul uses himself as an illustration. If we go back to chapter 4, where he says, verse 17, then we who are alive and remain shall be caught up together with them, that is the believers that have died, in the air, and thus we shall always be with the Lord. So he's using himself as an illustration, which Paul does elsewhere, for those that would be alive at the time of the rapture. He's just making an illustration. But now, when we go to 5:9, for God did not appoint us to wrath, but to obtain deliverance through our Lord Jesus Christ. In this book, he is not using we and us in the same way that he did in Ephesians. In Ephesians, he used we for Jewish believers. He used you for Gentile believers. He does not do that here in 1 Thessalonians. He is using it as a term that is true for himself and his reader, but is also true for the entire church. Now, let's see how we can demonstrate that. God did not appoint us. Well, what group does Paul belong to that the Thessalonians also belong to?
Church.
Church. And so that's where, because it was a predominantly Gentile congregation and so on and so forth, so it cannot be we Jews. The only we group that's going to fit is we the church. So it logically broadens out. 1 Thessalonians is the first, actually the second book that Paul wrote. And so in Revelation, it is not necessary to directly discuss the rapture, because it is a truth that has already been set forth. And so what Jesus is able to say is, I promise to deliver you. I promise to prevent you from entering that hour. But he didn't have to specify the means. Now, interestingly, when we look at 1 Thessalonians, we find that the rapture does more than prevent us from entering the tribulation. It also brings us into the presence of the Lord. And it does so both for living and for deceased believers. But in Revelation, he is not speaking about the positive deliverance. He is speaking of the negative deliverance only. Whereas in 1 Thessalonians, he speaks about both. Because the church is not destined for wrath. That would be deliverance to prevent entering something negative. But we would instead always be with the Lord, which is talking about the positive deliverance that the rapture provides. So that is truly a rapture passage, whereas I take Revelation 3:10 as having relevance to the rapture, but it is not precisely a rapture passage.
I like that argument. And you probably did it here.
I have written on it footnotes on the bottom of page one are places where I have written. I wrote back in 1999 and 2000. I guess both of them were in 2000. And there, in one of the articles, I cataloged all 1,100 uses of the word hati, which is either not translated or translated that or translated because. Well, it's in the chart.
So bottom line here, John, in Revelation, is he's promising to keep them from the testing of that trial. Is that right?
What he's saying is, I'm going to give you ministry opportunity. I'm going to open a door, and I'm going to give you testimony in front of your persecutors to show that I've loved you, not them, because of your faithfulness. But I'm not leaving you out on a limb. I also will keep you from entering the hour. You see, he's saying, you've got your persecutors, and I'm wanting you to remain faithful. You only have a little strength. They've got a lot of strength. They're the ones with the power, and they're putting the screws to you. But I'm not just forgetting about you. I'm not going to let you enter that terrible hour. But he doesn't condition it on their faithfulness. The rapture is true for all believers, regardless of whether or not we measure up to the same level as is evident there in Philadelphia.
Okay, so say that again. So it's not, so being a believer, regardless of your doing, faithfulness.
Say that one, please. All believers, all church-age believers are guaranteed that they will not enter the hour, because whether living or dead, faithful or unfaithful, we will all be raptured.
So that might concern the believer versus faithful.
Okay, let me set up a chart.
No, I'm sorry.
I can do this really fast. Look at 1 Thessalonians. The outline passage for 1 Thessalonians is 1 Thessalonians 1, verses 9 and 10. Paul is saying that other people testify, for they themselves declare concerning us what manner of entry we had to you, and how you turned from God to idols, to serve the living and true God. And those are delineating separate sections up to chapter 4, verse 13. And 4:13 and following is all described by verse 10. And to wait for his Son from heaven, whom he raised from the dead, even Jesus, who delivers us from the wrath to come. This is not talking about hell. Wrath is always temporal. And it is talking about preventing them from entering the tribulation. So now we get to the chapter 4, verse 13. And Paul had only been there sometime between, say, 20 days and 27 days. It's hard to know how long he was there in Thessalonica exactly, but he was there for a short period of time. He was run out of town on a rail. People were attacking him physically and so on and so forth. He was forced to leave the city, and the Thessalonians had persecution that was going on after he left. Some of the people within their congregation died, apparently by the persecution that occurred. And so that meant that they sent a letter to Paul asking him some questions. One of those questions comes up in verse 13 of chapter 4. Let's see. Every time in this book he says concerning something, he's addressing a point that they raise in their questions. 4:9, but concerning brotherly love, they ask about that. 4:13, but I do not want you to be ignorant, brethren, concerning those that have fallen asleep, those that have died. And 5:1, but concerning the times and seasons. Those are dealing with separate questions they ask. The end of chapter 4, he's saying, whether someone has died or they're still alive at the time of the rapture, they'll both be raptured. But he says the dead ones get a head start, and then the ones who are alive then catch up with them. So there, what he's saying at the end of chapter 4 is believers, whether living or dead, will be raptured. And in chapter 5, verses 1 through 11, he has more good news. Let me show you why I would say both of these are good news. Look at how he concludes chapter 4, verse 18. Therefore, comfort one another with these words. That means these are comforting words. And now notice verse 11 of chapter 5. Therefore, comfort each other and edify one another just as you are doing. So he's saying this is a comforting message also on a little bit different topic. And what he's saying here is whether we are watchful, whether we're living an observant life trying to please the Lord, or whether we are living in license, we shall all live together with him. Verse 10. Why? Because of verse 9. For God did not appoint us, the church, to wrath, but to obtain deliverance through our Lord Jesus Christ, who died for us, that whether we wake or sleep, we should live together with him. So what I would argue is we end up having in the last section of chapter 4 and the first section of chapter 5, a 2x2 chart. Whether we are living at the time of the rapture or deceased at the time of the rapture, we get raptured. And whether we're pleasing to the Lord or displeasing to the Lord at the time of the rapture, we get raptured. So it's good news for everyone except those that he mentioned in 4:13. Look at 4:13. In 4:13, he says, but I do not want you to be ignorant, brethren, fellow believers, concerning those who have fallen asleep, lest you sorrow as others who have no hope. He's not saying don't grieve when someone dies, but he's saying don't grieve hopelessly when a believer dies. Unbelievers are the ones without hope. So he says don't grieve like an unbeliever grieves who has no expectancy of being with the Lord. So notice, believers, whether they are alive or dead, whether they are obedient or disobedient, will all be raptured. But the unbeliever has no such hope.